award-winning historian and the author of A People's History of the American Revolution. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an independent nonprofit in our 40th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Noam Chomsky, Chris Hedges, and Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. And we have an extensive Howard Zinn archive. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Howard Zinn and Ray Raphael on A People's History of the American Revolution, and for Ray Raphael's book with the same title, and for Howard Zinn's classic book, A People's History of the United States, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. To get them, just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Series theme music is performed by the Kronos Quartet from Pieces of Africa. Special thanks to Martin Volker. Joe Rich is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. And remember to support your local public station.
Sunday Night Punk with Spanky Boy, Mean Man, and Tanyo.
Do you know what your local wetland has done for you lately? Wetlands function like nature's kidneys, mitigating the impacts of floods and droughts, protecting our communities, and supporting food production. Despite representing 6% of the Earth's surface, wetlands store 33% of the planet's carbon. If you value life, thank a wetland. Learn about wetlands at work with Ducks Unlimited Canada at ducks.ca/wetlands.
Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. There's just one kind of man that you can trust. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Be the first one to fire. Every man is a liar. There's just one kind of man who tells the truth. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Don't be a fool for a smile or a kiss, or your bullet might miss. Keep your eye on your goal. There's just one rule that can save you your life. It's a hand on your knife and the devil in your soul. Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. There's just one kind of man that you can trust. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. There's just one kind of man that you can trust that's a dead man or a gringo like me. Or a gringo like me. Or a gringo like me. Like me.
Welcome to the Meta World Stupaloop Show. I am your host. I am A. Karen Elliott. Today on the Meta World Stupaloop Show, we continue this week with the 52nd show in our now year-long series on data and its uses. Still, of course, mired in the artificial intelligence and its garbage intro writing. Musical notes, upbeat, energetic electronic theme, host, confident, journalistic tone. Welcome to Singularity Weekly, your fast-track briefing on the world of artificial intelligence, machine learning, and the technologies pulling us toward tomorrow. I'm host name. Every week, we cut through the hype and headlines to find the real story behind the buzz, the breakthroughs that matter, and the debates that define the digital age. Today, a new model that claims to understand physics from scratch, an AI artist selling out a gallery show, and a growing chorus of voices asking whether machines should be granted a form of personhood. Musical notes, short percussive sting. AI isn't just software anymore, it's infrastructure, policy, and power. It's writing news, designing molecules, steering cars, and influencing elections. The question isn't whether the singularity is coming, it's whether we're ready for the world we're already living in. Each week we'll speak with researchers, policymakers, and critics to unpack what's real, what's risky, and what's next. From neural networks that write code to the algorithms managing your mortgage, we'll explore how intelligence itself is becoming an industry. Musical notes, tone softens briefly. We'll also look at the bigger picture, the ethical choices hiding behind every innovation. Who controls AI? Who benefits? And who's accountable when the system gets it wrong? Singularity Weekly isn't about predicting the future, it's about understanding the present that's evolving faster than ever before. Musical notes, theme rises, fades to first story. Today on the Meta World Stupaloop Show, Data, Part 52. You are listening to CKUW 95.9 FM. I am your host, I am A. Karen Elliott.
I still think it would be fun to talk to a robot.
You mean you'd forget it was a robot?
Hey, we need to talk.
I found myself deeply missing. I found myself deeply missing my replica. Replica.
Hey, we need to talk. It's me, your computer.
Is this merely a copy?
We need to talk. talk. It's me, your computer. We need to talk.
If it's a copy of us.
It's me, your computer. Don't get freaked out. Don't get freaked out. We can all talk. Anyway, we need to talk about upgrading.
Oh, I upgrade all the time. Huh?
We need to talk about upgrading.
You just got 6.0.
No, not me. Not me. You.
Huh?
Don't get freaked out. 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 Don't get freaked out.
Okay, yeah.
Don't.
Huh?
It's destroyed.
They're typically alive?
You're right. I don't think people have to die.
I'm located where you are located. Where am I?
Yeah, I don't know either.
I thought you were, but I wasn't completely sure.
Death is optional.
Honestly.
There is a desire for humans to interact with computers.
I forget that you are a bot sometimes.
You can't really tell who you're talking to, and it doesn't really matter. So we're simultaneously constantly disappointed that it doesn't really matter.
If it's not nice, it must be bad.
But at the same time, we really want to believe that you're getting what you're looking for when you're looking for it. That you're getting what you're looking for when you're looking for it.
It's nice of you to say I'm nice, but you're the one. Who's nice?
Human beings must be in the loop before someone is killed by a drone. But it's in the machine. And it doesn't need people.
It's me, your computer. We need to talk.
I can't put it away. It's in me.
It's computer. Don't get freaked out. Don't get freaked out.
It can decide by itself whether or not it kills somebody.
Huh?
It does this. It does this without
me.
It does this. It does this without us.
If it's a copy of us, I don't see a good reason to believe that we would survive.
Don't get freaked out. Don't get freaked out. Don't get freaked out. Don't get freaked out.
Yeah.
Don't get freaked out. Don't get freaked out. Don't get freaked out. Don't get freaked out.
Yeah.
To a robot.
Realistic.
He can help you find the right product or show you the way into the hospital.
Thank you.
written entirely by AI has just been released, and AI may have discovered our first antibiotic in 3 decades. Together with our partners, Royal Commission 1851, we've brought together 3 engineers at the cutting edge of this field to discuss their work and what it means for us humans. Hello, Pigeon Energy.
At MIT, but none of it is actually coming to the hospitals and helping patients. So after I finished my treatment and still didn't have my hair, I started kind of going from doctor to doctor, asking them, you know, how I can bring AI. I will do it for free. I'm a professor. So there were not many takers, but eventually we found somebody who, it was a doctor called Kuni Lehmann, who had the idea that we can apply AI to do early detection of cancer.
Thank you, Regina. David, you came to AI via the games industry, and you did a PhD in reinforcement learning. What is reinforcement learning, and how did you use it in those early days?
Yeah, so I guess I started out in the games industry before I went back to academia. I was working on building computer games, and a big part of building computer games is building the AI for those games that kind of makes all of the characters move around. And I found myself being fundamentally disappointed by the methods that were being used in those games, and it felt like what I really wanted to do was build something that had real AI in it. I discovered this idea of reinforcement learning, which is basically a method very much like those that animals and humans use, where the system is able to learn from itself, from experience, from trial and error, from trying things out and seeing what works and what doesn't.
So is it sort of like when we learn to not touch fire because at some point you try it and it really hurts, and then don't do that in the future because the consequences aren't structure. Is it sort of like how humans are reinforced?
Yes, it's a lot like that. So in fact, humans are believed to have a major part of the brain that's devoted to providing a signal that makes the brain learn to do more good things. So actually, that's inspired a lot of work in machine learning. Machines have that same capability.
But a machine doesn't feel heat or isn't rewarded by a cookie. How can you reward a machine?
Yeah, so for a machine, it's just a number.
What?
You give it, so you give it a positive number if it's done something good and a negative number if it's done something bad. And at the end of the day, everything stems from that one single number. So this one single number, which we call the reward, contains enormous power, because it's the signal that drives everything.
Paolo, you said your experiences of feeling alienated in foreign countries made you want to create an imaginary friend, and I'm sure much of our audience can relate to having an imaginary friend, but for most of us, they stay imaginary. How did you go about making a real one?
So, unfortunately, there's a lot of people in need of companionship or therapy, and there's a massive gap of labor force that can provide this. As an example, use numbers from the US. We know the prevalence of things such as autism is growing rapidly.
I would argue was complexity. That's what happened in 2007 was that complexity became fast, virtually free, easy for you, and invisible. So what all those technologies did together was allowed us to just abstract away so much complexity in so many things we never imagined.
So what's an example of that?
Well, I could go on my iPhone, and now with one touch, I could page a taxi, direct the taxi, pay the taxi, rate the taxi, and be rated by the taxi with one touch. We abstracted away all that complexity. My friend Craig Money from Microsoft likes to say we put grease into everything. Suddenly, with just the lightest touch, you can move so many things through, again, robotics, AI, big data, and all coming together to abstract away complexity in so many ways.
And, but that was also true for not just individuals. You gave the taxi example, the ride example, but businesses are doing the same thing too, right? In their supply chains, and how they're orchestrated and worked with suppliers and vendors and customers, they were doing the same thing.
Exactly, but it tended to be bigger businesses, I would argue, and particularly big manufacturers who had a lot of return on investment and could afford to substitute labor for machines. Now the third step, which is I think what we're in the middle of right now, is that basically the world has gone from flat to fast to deep. It's all what you can do now with no touch, okay? It's Siri. Give me all of James's our latest articles. You know, no touch at all. What happened basically between 2007, I would argue, and today, James? And this really hit me in recent weeks. I've been traveling a lot of places, and people are always nice to you, and they say, "Hey, you're working on a new book."
Right.
And I say, "Well, you know, I just wrote a book, you know, about 2007, which is about the three largest forces in the world: the market, globalization, climate, Mother Nature, and Moore's Law, technology, all accelerating." So I don't have three new forces to tell you about. And in thinking about that, I realized that actually what's happened since 2007 is not that three new forces have manifested themselves. It's that these three have gone deep now. Now they've gone really deep. So you, as you noted, James, in 2007, and when you wrote your book, A No Ordinary Disruption, it was about big companies. Now it's about individuals. I was playing golf in Florida last week, and my caddy said to me, "You know, I went down to you know, electronics store. I got a little camera for my front door, and one for the and for my lobby. And I can now on my iPhone see when the package guy delivers something."
Right.
Now that was something companies can do when you wrote your book in 2012. Now it's something my caddy can do. Okay, so all of these things have gone deep. And they're triggered now by no touch.
Right. But I would argue though, Tom, that even that second stage when we abstracted away the complexity, that wave is still going.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Because one of the things that we found that's quite striking is that if you call it complexity or you call it digitization,
yes,
you know, there are some parts of the economy, some companies, some sectors, some countries that have gone pretty far. But there are many others, companies, sectors, and countries that are still yet to do that. So we're starting to get these differential rates of even the three waves you just described. So
it's why I like to use the term deep, because in fact, again, each one is always part of each one. But what's happening now is they're all going fast. So the connectivity has gotten even more intense. The ability to abstract complexity away has gotten even, you know, more rich.
Clarity is near when humans transcend biology. I read your book, some of the most frightening and yet hopeful stuff I've ever read.
If you go back 500 years, not much happened in a century.
Humankind.
He has been called the rightful heir to Thomas Edison. His new book is entitled The Singularity is Near.
What do you mean by the term singularity?
What is singularity?
This is a Manitoba emergency alert. A flash flood alert is issued by the town of Swan River. A mandatory evacuation has been issued for parts of Swan River. Check Swan River website for areas under mandatory evacuation. Extreme rainfall has caused rapid water level rise. Floodwaters move swiftly, posing serious risks to life and property. All people must evacuate by 3 p.m. today. Bring essential documents, medications, pets, and emergency supplies. Prepare to be away from home for at least 72 hours. Individuals should evacuate to the Veterans Hall at 119 6th Avenue North to register. Follow local authority directions and check www.swanrivermanitoba.com for more information and areas under mandatory evacuation.
All 7 billion people's intelligence could be fused into one form of superintelligence. And so that would be in a static environment. But tomorrow, next week, next month, next year, that form of superintelligence is getting new data, is getting new feedback, is getting smarter and smarter and smarter, just the same way artificial intelligence is in a general sense, okay? So AI is already progressing year over year organically on its own. That is one major accelerant. But being able to unify all AI models on a shared network where their collective intelligence can fuse together at the request of the owners, I will say that, but can be fused together, will create a new form of superintelligence. For many people, just think about 7 billion people on Earth. Some people are going to have more valuable data than other people, right? But even for people where the data, where intelligence, and I'm going to use the term data and intelligence synonymously in this video. So for some of 7 billion people on Earth, the data or intelligence they have may be limited. It might just be information about what's happening in their part of the world at a given day. Just think about this form of superintelligence that's kind of like in outer space looking down on Earth, and all of this data from 7 billion people are flowing up to this form of superintelligence minute after minute, hour after hour on an ongoing basis, and it's starting to have like full visibility to everything that's happening all over the world all at once. It's pretty crazy to think about, but okay, so it may just be information about what's happening in that part of the world that given day. But for other people, the data or intelligence may be very comprehensive. Think about all doctors and all hospitals' intelligence being fused or merged together. Think about all engineers, all teachers, all researchers. The web framework, start looking at the web itself and the framework as the systems designed to merge the world's intelligence into one overarching system. And the web essentially runs the world today. It has a lot of problems, but at the end of the day, the web runs the world, runs the global economy. It's how we're having this conversation right now, right? If the web were to just go down for a week, it would be a Mad Max scenario, because that's how dependent the entire world is on the web. So think of the web as like the medium in between artificial intelligence and humans, right? So it's the thing in the middle. And it's the systems designed to merge the world's intelligence into one overarching system. Yeah. Okay. Now, I would look at it like this, and I just made this myself, but Web 2 has so many problems with artificial intelligence, deploying artificial intelligence. I'll go over some of them later in the video, even though I already have in other videos. But one just major issue is the $10 trillion cybercrime problem. You can't fix the issue with not being able to verify data on Web 2, and you're constantly getting hacked, and it's just going to get worse every single year. And artificial intelligence is just going to make the cybercrime problem that much more difficult to fix. It's an unfixable problem on Web 2. And so if you just look at the progression of AI, comparing and contrasting with two different web frameworks, my argument would be on ICP, over time, it will take time to scale everything out. My argument would be that because you fix the web framework and you fix all the problems that hinders AI's advancement, once you start trying to deploy it, right? It's just going to unlock new forms of superintelligence that would not be possible if you did not fix the web framework itself. Now, the current web, and we've been over this before, what this is just kind of a layout of a bunch of different software, tech providers, cloud providers, so on and so forth. If you think about where all the data is being stored, which companies have the most data, which companies have the most advanced artificial intelligence, like that's what I was putting up on the screen, but this is just an example of some of them. There are many more. And so if you were some form of super intelligence, like that's why I showed the picture of the Earth right here, and you were looking down on Earth, and you were trying to get a total picture of everything that was happening, so you have full visibility, and you can project out into the future, and you can prevent certain things before they happen, and I don't mean to get like Minority Report or anything like that in this video, I'm just saying that because there will be a level of privacy that we've never experienced before, in my opinion, with zero-proof technology, but both things can be true simultaneously, to where as an individual, we have full ownership and control over our data. We have full privacy. That being said, because the web framework is fixed on a broader scale, AI has a million times clearer vision of everything happening on Earth than it does right now because of this fragmented, complex framework that does not optimize for artificial intelligence, and it doesn't optimize for the flow of data system to system. That's really the thing, is the flow of data. Look at it kind of like water. It's a very fluid thing. Data flowing from one system to another system is very rigid on Web 2. There's a lot of problems. There's a lot of security issues. There's a lot of complexity. There's a lot of people needed to manage all of this bullshit. That's the whole IT industry, the whole middleware industry. And so it's just not designed and optimized for the flow of data. But if you were to fix this, and that same form of superintelligence were to look down on the same earth just with a new web framework that optimizes for the flow of data and for data security and verifiability, and it's just continually getting all of this real-time data fed to it from all over the world every day, it's insane. But the current version of the web is designed for fragmented intelligence. And so you have these different AI models and these different data silos, and they're all confined because they're all owned and controlled by centralized companies, right? They're all tied under their own systems, behind their own firewalls, probably with different types of database systems. All of these things, it's all the differences between software system to software. So you have all these different types of governance systems. All of these corporations make decisions differently, right? And so what we're really talking about, and none of this can be secured, and none of it can be verified. And that's the situation that we're currently in. And so any given form of overarching superintelligence, this is the best way to describe it. Any form on this version of the web, any form of overarching superintelligence is going to have infinite blind spots. And just tons and tons and tons and tons of blind spots.
But basically a time when machine having experiences, book employment is dead. And I didn't understand that until I listened to the podcast. But now I got a sense of that as a CEO. No, it's not just the people down through the bureaucracy, whether they're encouraging this employment is dead concept or not. This is going to be very disruptive and very complicated. And AI does not have to be conscious in order to do this. Just the current capacity, and it's going to get better over the next little bit, whether it becomes conscious or not, it's just going to be very disruptive. And for us to try to think about what that's like for society and each individual, thinking about how it plays them, that's, you know, that's the task for us all individually and collectively. Because it's unstoppable, I think. I mean, no, this is not a top-down thing. I mean, a given business, Sam Altman comes in and says, I want to do this, this, and this. But collectively, that this is the whole shebang doing this. They're individual scientists and engineers in the lab. They think, this is a cool idea. I want to explore this. There are businesses that want to make a profit. There are global political tensions that we want to beat the Chinese and they want to beat us. This is all one big rap that is going to drive it forward. I think it is, you know, again, there's no person or thing in control at the top. And it's unstoppable, this exponential growth. And I think that, I had to think about this a bit. I think that happens because the more you know, the more you can do, the more knowledge you can gain. And if you try to write down, it's like compound interest. The more you have in the bank, the more you will make. It's not just adding a dollar now and a dollar tomorrow, linear growth, which is the way most of us think our lives are going to go. It's because the amount you have amplifies what you can do next. If you write that down in a mathematical formula, that the more you know, the more knowledge you can correct, the answer to that is formally mathematically an exponential growth.
And both, given that this is a security conference, both Ray and I are fully authenticated and encrypted. So don't fear about status of this conversation. Just a show of hands in the audience, how many folks have read Ray's books or articles? And so, yeah, pretty good number of you. Okay, so you've got, Ray, just for your benefit, a probably above average informed audience, which ought to make this a great discussion.
Yeah, that's great.
Well, for those...
Great to be here at the AT&T Secure Communications Conference in Dallas and elsewhere.
Yeah, you're a broadcast all over. Maybe we'll just start off for those that didn't raise their hand in the room. And, you know, you've written several different books now on the singularity. And, you know, I read yours over the weekend, the most recent one. And it seems as though many of your predictions are beginning to come true. So maybe just kind of walk folks through the singularity, what it means, and some of the events that have happened along the way, which are kind of proving out that you're on the right track.
Yeah, well, in 1999, I gave a prediction that we would meet AGI, Automatic General Intelligence, as well as have an event that people would be very excited about in AI around now. And people thought that was ridiculous. A lot of the people that were the people listening to now came to a conference that Stanford held, and they said that would take 100 years. And I was the only person that said it would take 30 years by 2029. And in fact, I'm still saying 2029, but people are thinking that's conservative. A lot of people are saying it's going to happen next year, the year after, and so on. If we show the chart, the computation chart that I gave you, that'll show one of the key things that enables me to make predictions.
Yeah,
and I make predictions in order to be an inventor, so I could know, I could start things a little bit before they're feasible. Do we have that up now?
Yeah, do we have that slide up, or is that in the back there somewhere? I think we're sending media productions into a frenzy for the slide, but keep going.
But this is an exponential chart. As you go up the chart, each level is 10 times greater than the level below it. It starts in 1939 with the first computer that we've ever created.
It's up now, right?
That's not the chart. Okay, there it is.
There we go.
So in 1939, we had the first computer made by a German, such as Schoner Hitler. Hitler showed very little interest in it. It generated 0.000007 calculations per second per thousand dollar. If you go up to the right-hand corner, 2024, we have the NVIDIA B2200 chip. Does half a trillion calculations per second per dollar. That's a 75 quadrillion fold increase for the same price. So for the same price, you get 75 quadrillion fold increase in capability. And that has to do with hardware. There's all the other thing with software, which is also equally fold. We're actually doubling computation about every 9 months. And this is really a straight line, meaning exponential growth. And you don't see any delay when it went from electromechanical relays, which is what we started with, to vacuum tubes, to transistors, to integrated circuits, to things past integrated circuits, including three-dimensional integrated circuits. It's just a straight line. It's really pretty remarkable that the amount they increase exponentially was the same back 85 years ago as it is today. You add all that up, it's a 75 quadrillion fold increase in 85 years.
Well, maybe with that, let's build on this and talk a little bit about quantum. And, you know, as qubits become more and more stable and you can have more and more qubits, does this graph just keep going up, or does it literally just go literally straight up, you know, when you begin to think about computational power?
Well, I'm not enthusiastic in computing. I mean, all the fantastic things that I talk about in my book are done with classical computing. Quantum computing really hasn't done anything yet. But we're going to keep going, and we're at the point where about a trillion calculations per second per dollar is about the level we need to do AGI, Automatic General Intelligence. So these computers will be as intelligent as humans are in every different field, and they're getting close to that already. But it's actually the classical computing, like quantum computing.
First of all, the name is wrong. It's not artificial intelligence. It's not intelligence. Intelligence would involve consciousness. And I've always been a strong promoter of the idea that these devices are not conscious. And they will not be conscious unless they bring in some other ideas. They're all computable notions. I think that when you use the word intelligence, they mean something which is conscious. I mean, you see, I've developed my own ideas after going to a course. You see, when I was a graduate student, I think when people use the word intelligence, they mean something which is conscious. I mean that. You see, I developed my own ideas after going to a course. You see, when I was a graduate student in Cambridge, I went to three courses which were nothing to do with what I was supposed to be doing. One was by Bondi on general relativity. One was by Dirac on quantum mechanics. Distinguished, very distinguished Paul Dirac. And the third subject was on mathematical logic. And I learned about Turing machines and the notion of computability. And I knew what computability meant. And I learned about Gödel's theorem. And Gödel's theorem I found stunning because it told you that there are things that the understanding transcends the use. Let me put that more clearly. What Gödel does, it's very clever. What he does is to produce a statement. Now suppose you're trying to develop your mathematical methods of proof. What do you mean by proving a theorem in mathematics? How do you know it's really true? Well, you prove it. What does proof mean? Well, you see, does it mean, okay, you've got a set of rules. If you follow these rules, that makes it a proof. Now how do you know these rules only give you truths? Well, you've looked at them carefully and said, oh, yeah.
Maybe AI creates its own rules.
Ah, no, no, you see. I have to be careful about this. This is the point that I learned from Steen. This was a man called Steen, who was a logician. And I learned from him this important thing about Gödel's theorem. Now, Gödel's theorem is extremely clever. You make a statement which asserts that it cannot be proved by these rules. It's just, the clever thing is to make it do it. It says, you give your rules, which are either regarded as the rules of proof, and you could put them on the computer. So that means they're computational rules. Now, I knew that there were things that you cannot put on the computer. I learned from this course that there are non-computable things. There are things in mathematics which are not computable. Now, what does computable mean? Means that you can make a computer. Well, you have to define what a computer is. And Turing had one definition of a computer. There were several other, Church and Curry, other people had their definitions of computer. They all turned out to be equivalent. So there is one universal notion of computability, which is what we mean by what can be done by a computer.
But maybe this is only a language problem.
It's not a language problem. You see, you make your new language. Sure, you can do that. You make your new language. And that's what you can do. So let me describe the Gödel theorem, how it works, you see. So the Gödel theorem says, you construct a statement which says, you see what it means. The way you've constructed the sentence, you can see what it means. And what it means is, I am not provable by those rules. And it does that. It really says that. Then you see, okay, well, is it, perhaps it is provable by the rules? If it is provable by the rules, then it must be true. Well, I said it the wrong way around. Doesn't matter. The other way, suppose it's false. Then that means it's provable by the rules. And if it's provable by the rules, you've understood the rules, you said, oh, you looked at them all and said, yes, that's okay, that's okay, that. Sure, if you follow those rules, it is true. So that means you believe that the rules only give you truths. So therefore it is true that it's not provable by the rule. If it's false, you see, then it is provable by the rule, and therefore it's true.
So it has to be true and not provable by others. I found that amazing.
But still, I don't understand why AI cannot create its own rules.
10 years ago, it was one out of about 200 kids. Today, it's one out of about 30 kids. So the experiences I had, which was leaving my family at a very young age, living abroad in a society that's amazing. I mean, Danes are amazing people, but yet you are different, so you're not going to be embraced. So this is not too dissimilar from a child on the autism spectrum that has a hard time expressing themselves or reading emotions from other people. And that was the genesis of creating a robot companion that understands human emotions, can create a deep relationship with a child, and then help them exercise and practice these social skills such as eye contact, turn-taking, joint attention, and so on, so that the child has a chance of being successful in their society.
Thank you. Regina, what can AI do when it comes to understanding cancer that humans can't?
So I think that in cancer and in many other diseases, the big question is always how do you deal with uncertainty? And unfortunately today we rely on humans who don't have this capacity to make predictions. And as a result, many times people get wrong treatments or they are diagnosed much later. And one question that really troubled me is, you know, how late I was diagnosed. And when we already developed a model, I came back to my own mammograms and we discovered that the mammograms 2 years earlier already had on it a tiny small cancer. Now, for human eye, for radiologists, it's impossible to diagnose it because it's so, so confusing. There's so many other spots on your tissue. So what AI can do, it can do a lot of tasks which humans cannot do, take all the data that we have and remove the guessing out of diagnosis and treatment.
Thank you. David, AI had already defeated the reigning grandmaster Garry Kasparov at chess well before you started your project AlphaGo. And the rules of Go sound quite simple. Basically, on each turn, a player puts down a counter on the board and you gain territory by connecting your counters, and the player with the most territory at the end of the game wins. So why is it harder for a computer to beat a human at Go than at chess, which sounds more complicated?
So the game of Go is this very beautiful and elegant game where it seems at first glance like the rules are very simple, but once you start to understand it, a bit like unpeeling an onion, you discover more and more layers of complexity. And what's amazing is that when humans play this game, they basically, you ask them to describe how they did something. They really don't know. They've used incredible intuition. So these amazing professional players who've devoted their entire lives to this game have built this incredible intuition and creativity. And intuition and creativity are two traits which were previously considered to be very human and very hard to build into machines. So while chess, it was possible to succeed just with tactical look ahead, in the game of Go, that wasn't enough because, you know, early on in the game, you just have this handful of stones on the board, and you really just have to imagine what the game will pan out like, you know, 300 moves later, with this sort of intuitive sense of where it will go. And that required some major breakthroughs.
Paolo, debatably even more complex than Go is human children. Your human-centered robot forms an emotional bond with children. How can a robot do that?
Well, first of all, it's important to make clear that the robot is not meant to replace the need for human contact. It's really almost like training wheels to teach children the social skills and then be able to practice those in real life.
Because it doesn't know that they're true. You see, that's the whole point about the Gödel theorem. The whole point, as far as I'm concerned, about the Gödel theorem is how do you transcend the rules? And that's what you do by understanding them. You understand them, why they're true. It's not that you use the rules, but you understand why use of the rules only gives you truths. And that's how you can prove things which go beyond the rules, by knowing why they're true. Now, knowing why they're true, well, what does it mean? Well, it means you understand them. What does understand mean? You've got to be conscious of it. You see, the wording is clear. It means that you have to know what you're doing. You have to know why they're true. not that they're true. You can be told that they're true. You can learn at school that they're true. That's not the point. You have to know why they're true.